Welcome to Truest Blood, the official True Blood podcast.
I'm Kristen Bauer.
And I'm Deborah Ann Wohl.
And you've been invited in. I want to do bad things with you.
On Truest Blood. Welcome back to Truest Blood, where we sink our fangs into the series bite by bite.
This week, we jump ahead a year and return to Bon Tom for season 4 of True Blood. Woo! We are delighted to have Scott Winant with us. His work on the series was foundational. So much of what is beloved of this series was inspired by his directorial input.
I mean, you've heard me say it multiple times. I apologize to every other director we had on True Blood. All of you are spectacular, but Scott Winant is far and above my favorite director I've ever worked with. And he was my first director on the show.
I was going to say, he's your, what would be the expression? Your
the appropriate.
You lost your Jessica virginity.
Popping of the cherry.
Yes. Thank you. I had no idea how to go there. So first, let's have a not actually so quick bite. Season 4 recap, Deb. You did an amazing job writing this, sister. A lot happened.
These are the hardest parts of this job, I have to say.
I'm glad you're taking this one on. I mean, how many words is this?
It started at 1,700 words.
Ooh, of course.
And I was able to cut it down to 1,100, which is better. I apologize to anyone whose storyline got axed. We went for brevity and clarity on this one.
Yeah. I mean, hats off to you. This is amazing. And here we go. And here comes trouble.
We begin this season in a magical fairyland, and Barry is there, and Grandpappy Earl is there, and Queen Mab is there, but she's oddly insistent that they all eat of the fruit. Turns out, it's all an illusion. Fairies are actually goblins, and Mab is trying to kidnap them. Sookie and Earl escape by the skin of their teeth, only to have him turn to dust in the Bon Tom Cemetery.
And that's the last time we deal with that storyline kind of ever again.
Sookie runs home to discover a year has passed since she disappeared, and Jason, presuming she was dead, sold her house to none other than Eric Northman.
My daddy. Everyone else has had a comparatively mellow year in the last 12 minutes. Jason became a cop while Andy got addicted to V. Tara became a lesbian cage fighter. Sam joined a shifter anger management group. And Terry and Arlene are raising Renee's baby. Lafayette and Jesus are happily domestic, while Jessica and Hoyt are decidedly not. And Bill is the vampire king of Louisiana.
My daddy. Witchy woman.
Things seem to have been remarkably death and drama free for the Bon Tom crowd, but now that Sookie is back, trouble is too. The big problem this year seems to be a small coven of witches led by a medium named Marnie. When Tara, Lafayette, and Jesus join her circle, she somehow gains the power to control the dead.
Seeing as vampires are dead, this understandably freaks the fuck out of King Bill. He sends Eric to shut down the coven, but when Eric threatens the witches, they cast a spell to wipe him of all his memories. Later, Sookie comes upon the inexplicably shirtless
and bizarrely shoeless,
we don't know why, Eric Northman, wandering the side of the road and takes him in.
Family values.
Sam starts a relationship with a single mother named Luna, whose ex happens to be a jealous werewolf, Marcus, pack leader of Shreveport. Tommy goes back to his mother, only to be jumped by his father, and instead Tommy kills them both. Sam helps him dispose of the bodies, but this trauma gives way to a new power. Tommy can now skinwalk as another human. And speaking of happy families...
Yes. Jason, who has been looking out for the folks at Hotshot, gets kidnapped by them in return. Crystal is back, and she wants Jason to make panther babies with all the Hotshot ladies. After days of torture and abuse, Jason manages to escape. When Jess and Hoyt find him battered and unconscious, Jess gives Jason her blood to save him.
in the full moonlight.
As the moon waxes full, everyone gets a bit randy. Alcide, who is back with a now sober Debbie, is clearly hung up on Sookie, and Debbie knows it. Well, Sookie is totally gaga over Amnesia Eric, and they do it for like 3 episodes straight in every possible vignette you could possibly think of. Jason has sexy, guilty dreams about Jess, and they bond as they wait to see if he turns into a werepanther.
Spoiler alert.
He does not.
The only person not having a sexy time is Pam.
Yep.
When she demanded that the coven fix Eric, they instead cursed her face, her beautiful face. With both her maker and her beauty at stake, she vows to kill every last witch. Meanwhile, Jesus and Lafayette head to Mexico to talk to Jesus's brujo uncle about how they can get out of this mess, to learn that Jesus has a demon and Lafayette is a powerful medium, very much like Marnie.
Witches be bitches.
Currently, Marnie is possessed by a badass witch named Antonia. Now, she was assaulted and tortured by vampires during the Spanish Inquisition, and her biggest claim to fame is that she once cast a spell that forced all the vampires within 20 miles to walk into the sun. Now she is back, and she wants revenge. And with their powers combined, they are now Captain Martonia!
Martonia and the coven used her trick to bring the vampires into the light, but King Bill was prepared, and the vampires chain themselves in silver, thwarting her plan. After several skirmishes between the coven and the vamps, Martonia is able to gain control over several vampires, but loses Eric when Sookie uses her fairy blast on him, restoring his memories as well.
Wow, that fairy blast keeps coming in handy. Huh? Merlot's wrap up.
Now that Tommy can skinwalk as Sam, he fires Sookie and sleeps with Luna.
Ew.
When Sam finds out, he nearly strangles Tommy. And when Marcus comes looking for Sam, Tommy takes the beating and dies in Sam's arms on that pool table.
Boy, that table has seen a lot of action.
Marcus then hooks up with a hurt Debbie and kidnaps Luna's daughter. Sam and Luna get her back, and when Marcus tries to kill Sam, Alcide breaks Marcus's neck. He then abjures Debbie.
Weird stuff continues to happen around baby Mikey. Arlene is convinced they are haunted by the ghost of Renee, but it turns out to be the ghost of a grieving mother who possesses Lafayette and kidnaps Mikey. Jesus comes to their rescue using his unique blend of compassion and magic to help her find some closure, and she passes on. The whole encounter exposes Andy's V addiction, and Terry helps him out with some tough love.
Moon goddess madness.
Martonia manages to capture Sookie and the rest of the coven in the shop with a protection spell, while Jason and the vamps are held at bay outside. Sensing that Marnie is now in the driver's seat, the coven begin to work on a way to release Antonia's spirit from Marnie's grasp. It takes Jesus' demon to achieve it, but they do, allowing Bill and Eric to take Marnie out.
But now that she knows about Lafayette and Jesus' powers, Ghost Marnie wants them for herself. She possesses Lafayette and kills Jesus. Marfayette ties Bill and Eric to a burning stake and is only stopped by a powerful spell from the coven. Ultimately, it is Antonia that appeals to Marnie after kind of a bizarrely short little conversation, and together they find peace in death.
But it ain't over till it's over.
A fed-up Nan Flanagan suggests a mutiny to Eric and Bill, who kill her instead. Terry gets a visit from an old army buddy with some bad vibes, while Andy consummates with a fairy with some very good vibes. Jessica breaks up with Hoyt and starts an open relationship with Jason, who in turn gets beat up by Hoyt. Russell Edgington seems to have escaped. Pam is on the outs with her maker, and Steve Newland shows up sporting some fang. Mm.
Sookie breaks up with both Eric and Bill and goes to lick her wounds with her bestie Tara, until a heartbroken Debbie shows up with a shotgun, blaming Sookie for everything that went wrong with Alcide. Tara selflessly takes the bullet for Sookie. Sookie shoots Debbie in the face, and we end the season with Tara bleeding in Sookie's lap, barely clinging to life.
We We are absolutely gaga to have Scott Winant be willing to talk with us. He directed more episodes of True Blood than any other director we had. He's had an illustrious career, including...
Oh my gosh, 9 Emmy nominations, 2 Emmy wins, although a Golden Globe, a Peabody Award, DGA nominations, Film Fest win for Best Director, and a People's Choice Award. I mean, we saw a lot of statues behind him as we
saw a lot of Emmys, more than 2.
I think more than 2 Emmys there. But he began his career producing and directing on the enormously popular 30-something and continues.
Yeah, he's got more credits than I could list, with 26 producer credits, 49 directing credits. But a few of my faves are My So-Called Life, Carnival, Breaking Bad, Fargo, West Wing, The Shield, The Affair, Yellow Jackets, Veronica Mars, Californication, Grace and Frankie, and most recently, The Thing About Pam, whoever the hell that is.
She's not our Pam.
She's not me.
But without further ado, Scott Winant.
Yes.
Hey.
Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Oh, my gosh. Scott.
I know. So good to see you guys.
It's ridiculous to see
We're
you.
Really, really, really excited. Thank you for coming on and talking to us. You know, I think both of us, you are the directed the most episodes of True Blood. So
yeah.
We are so curious to hear what your experience was.
Well, I'm tired. Very tired.
10 years later.
Yeah, I'm still
tired.
Recovering.
So am I.
Yeah, I know. A lot of night shoots.
Yes.
I'm still dumbfounded by how the crew was able to do a whole season. I'd crawl to the end of an episode and then I'd have to go and recover. And yet the next day, these guys are coming back in and doing it all over again.
Months on end.
Yeah, really something.
We like to jump back to the beginning and sort of start with, how did you get the job? How did you come into this family?
Well, I was wandering by Alan's office. No, actually, it was interesting because I had never met Alan Ball, and I got a call. And he apparently was a fan, and which is strange because, you know, I just go about my business. I don't think anybody's really paying attention. He wanted me to come in, and it was an interesting situation because he was going into production, and I was going to do the first episode, but he was going to reshoot the pilot simultaneously. So he wanted somebody he could trust because he wasn't going to be around. The truth is he was off shooting on one stage and I was shooting on another. So, I came in and met. He was very complimentary. I loved him, obviously, and I still do. But so that's how it all began. And I did the very first episode and I also did the very last episode of the series. So I was very fortunate. And I really did feel like True Blood was, you know, my show. It was like, you know, my family. And even though I wasn't producing, you know, I felt I was a producer on the show, so.
That was actually one of my questions, because when I looked up your ridiculously long IMDb credits.
But there are none of the silence are on there, only the talkies.
Well, you have produced and directed so many incredible shows. And out of all of those shows, I believe True Blood, you directed the most episodes of. So you produced like 85 episodes of 30 something and so many shows, you know, produced 18 episodes of My So-Called Life and 20 episodes of Sacred Lies that we got to do together, Californication.
Yeah.
But 13 episodes directing is quite a bit ahead of other shows. Wow. So I was wondering how that felt to you.
Well, it was great because I wasn't a producer on the show. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to stick around for post-production and network meetings and story meetings. And I just came in and directed. And it's basically, it's action, cut. That was great. Let's do that again. That's pretty much it. So so much more with the producing part.
Ladies and gentlemen, a directing lesson from Scott Fleming.
That's pretty much it. Just do that and you'll have a bunch of Emmys.
But
it's not totally true because that's really for an actor more, I think, closer to the truth. Although we do a lot of work at home, Deb especially. I kind of wing it a bit. But you, as a director, all day long. First of all, you're directing all the scenes. So we're just in the scenes that we're in. And then also you are in a lot of meetings that lead up to filming. And then you are part of editing. And then you also get asked 8,006 questions all day. Do you like where that plant is?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think of this outfit?
Right, and from all the different departments, having to be literate in all of the different departments.
You have to be, your brain has to be on all the time. And you have to be present. And, it's funny, when I was producing 30-something, I brought in a lot of first-time directors because we didn't want any, we wanted a new feel. Hmm. Oh. And I remember when Joe Doherty was directing, one of our writers, he was literally overwhelmed with all the questions and the stuff. Yeah. And I remember being on set and the prop guy comes up to Joe with a plate saying 3 strips of bacon or 2. And Joe just went blank. And he couldn't, he didn't understand why he was being asked this question. What was the point of it? And so afterwards I took Joe aside and I said, look, Joe, that's your job. Everybody does their job and they care so desperately about the work they do. And you don't always have the answer, but you have to give one. And you have to respect the question. It's easy, Joe. Whenever it's 2 or 3, pick 3 because you can always take one away. And but you owe this guy an answer. And you have to, and sometimes it's, even if it's the wrong answer, you need to give an answer. And that's why you have to, and it's interesting because I know a lot of directors who just think about what's in front of them. But I'm not like that. I always think about what came before, what comes after. Mm-hmm. If Deborah asks me, I'm entering, but from where? I have to know where she's coming from. Mm-hmm. And then how much time she feels she has in this scene, what her obstacles are. I can't make that up. I do my homework and I think about all that.
So this is the thing that for me, Scott, just staggers me when I work with other directors. And there are a lot of really good directors, and we've had a lot of really great directors on True Blood, but there's something so unique about working with Scott Winant. And I think it is that. It's that you've come with so much insight already. Well, and yet that insight doesn't feel like it steps on my toes. It's synchronous.
Yeah, because I've helped a lot of directors, one of the things that that makes it easier is that, and with the two of you, it was always that way. I never give you a direction that isn't built on your performance. Mm-hmm. So I'm watching you and then I learn about the performance and the scene from what you do. And so when I get that, I'm not changing. I'm adapting. I'm building on what you bring. Now, it's interesting too, because sometimes it's a total left turn. When I was working with young actors on like My So-Called Life, an actress, a young girl would come into a scene and she's spent the whole week with her coach committing to an approach. And she comes to her first scene, and the producers are sitting next to me, and they go, that's completely fucking wrong. And I go, oh. So, and now I have to get her off of that. And she's scared. You know, she feels adrift and untethered. And so I'm very sensitive to that. And you have to take time. And then, of course, in order to get her off of it, I have to pick and choose the things that are working. Yeah. So that she has something to hang on to. And
that's the difference, right? That's what makes all the difference. It doesn't feel like you're being hijacked.
Well, I also am always amazed because I, you know, when I'm producing, I stand to the side and I watch and I see an actor on stage and a director yelling to go again and expressing disappointment and not giving a single anything. And I watch the actor start to have self-doubts, wondering what it is that he or she's not doing, and he or she's not getting anything. All they're hearing is disappointment. Mm-hmm. So, I just see it becomes toxic, and it's terrible. And one of the things I loved about True Blood was, you know, we shot on film. It was one of the last shows to shoot on film, but even more importantly, Alan always had live auditions. You know, now we live in this new age where we watch tapes and everybody weighs in, and you know, there's some upsides to it, no question about it, but to never actually adjust an actor before you work with them. Because I've had brilliant auditions, and then I get on stage and it's a disaster. And I've had terrible auditions, and when we get on stage, it's just brilliant. And you know, people have their strengths. I can tell you, I've chased after actors after auditions. You know how it is. They self-destruct and they just have a terrible audition. And I know on some level that the producers don't want to hire that actor. But I don't want that actor to leave the audition so defeated. So many times I ask them back the next day or something. And it's hard because I know that the casting director... Well, actually, the casting directors are always very pleased. But... the writers and producers, sometimes they're just like, are you kidding me? You know, are we? But I got to say, I think I have more empathy for actors than I do for anybody. I don't understand how you have the courage to do what you guys do. So,
It's a mix of courage and then also a mix of people pleasing, you know, and perfectionism and all those things that cause anxiety that do lead us to be real team players.
You know, it's so hard because sometimes you're abandoned. And then when you defend yourself or stand up for yourself, then they think you're difficult. You know, it's so crazy. You know, my father's an actor and my brother's an actor.
You have this family and your mom is a casting director and producer.
Yeah.
Your whole family is connected to the business. That's so interesting. Is that how I cut you off, but, and I want to, it was one of my questions is that's so interesting to grow up in an entertainment business focused family.
Well, you don't really think about it. My dad was he was really handsome, but he always played bad guys.
Yeah.
So, you know, every week I would see him get killed on television, you know, whether it was, you know, Hawaii 5-0 or Mannix or, you know, one of those shows.
Yeah.
And, but that seemed normal. I didn't even think too much about it. And, when I got older and I thought, oh, acting seems like something, I tried it. I have this disability. I have this reading problem. And I always got so nervous. I could never cold read. So I had to like memorize everything in advance. And then I got very good at improvising just because I had to. But I was too I just knew I couldn't stand not being in control. And that's what I admire so much about actors. That's where I say the courage comes from, is this idea that you can allow yourself to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And then that's where I feel responsibility as the director. If you're willing to do that for me, mm-hmm. well, then I better support you. Then I better make sure. I mean, and sometimes I even say to actors who are working really hard, all I say is I'm listening. I just want you to know I'm out here listening and I'm paying attention.
Stacey, I'm gonna quote it wrong. I believe it's Stacey Keach asked like what he wants in a director. And I think his quote is something like, see what I'm trying to do and help me do it better.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I work with directors who when the scene is happening, they're reading the script. Right. They're not even looking at the performance. They're just reading along. And I go, how can you direct if you're not, you know? So
you wouldn't believe it. I mean, well, you would believe it because you've produced so many things. But it really is for us when a director like you comes along, it's like a cup of water in the desert. And it can be crushing to have a director that is the opposite of you and then equally as reviving to work with you.
Well, I'm gonna embarrass you further with praise. So my very first night, you know, work on the show was your episode, and that night I remember I was one of those young actresses who does a lot of work. Now, I didn't have a coach, but I did work on my own. I came in very prepared, very nervous. There were all these more experienced people around me. It was really kind of my first job,
very hard scene,
night shoot, and sitting in a hair and makeup chair that I'd barely been in one before in my life. And you, as a director, did something no other director has ever done in the rest of my career for anyone I've ever met. You came in, you sat next to me in the hair and makeup chair, and you said, I know tonight's going to be hard. I want you to know that anything you need, if you need extra time, if you need to take a break, if you need help, I'm here. I mean, that maybe shouldn't be so unprecedented, but it is. And it set up the night so well for me. And I think in the spirit of, you know, encouraging others to do their best work reflects back on you and you're able to do your best work. You know, I can only imagine that it makes your job easier when the actors are, secure and on your team.
I had a big investment in that character, you know, when I cast it and lobbied for you to be Jessica. And it was also an unusual kind of scene to do for a first scene.
Yeah.
Because you literally open the trunk and you're at 100 miles an hour.
Yes. You know,
there was nowhere, there was no dialogue to ramp
no
up.
No ramp up.
Nothing to work with. I just open it up like a jack in the box and then you had to be in the moment. So, but again, to your credit, you did your homework. So how you were able to do that, I don't know. But it's interesting about both of you. You both make the people in the scenes with you better. And that's something I really enjoy. You know, it's funny with the character of Pam. She was, for me, always fun. I don't understand Pam. I don't. She's such a contradiction.
Do you, Kristen?
Yes. I do. She's in
Do you there. Understand Pam?
Yeah, Pam, I remember one of the first scenes, Kristen, we did, you were, Eric said, go to the swamp and, you know, kill this person or something. And
yeah, the main ad.
Yeah, and Pam's concern were her shoes, you know, because Pam never wore anything but high heels. And I go,
yes, that hurt.
Yeah, and I go, so this character just creates chaos, but she's always, you know, dressed for
yes.
And I think has an enormous heart, even if it's made of stone.
Yeah, I used to just say, I would come into the set and I would think, what does Audrey put her in today? Because you were in some sort of absurd, you know, sexy outfit, no matter what you were doing.
It was so absurd and uncomfortable and wonderful. And it was always such a thing. That would take 3 or 4 wardrobe fittings to get that stuff pulled together.
Mm. Well, one of the things that I noticed about the actors on the show was they always came back from Audrey, the wardrobe lady, from the costume designer, having just had a great time.
Yeah.
Going to wardrobe to work with the costume director seemed to be the most fun you had on the show.
It was.
And I didn't ever see it. I just saw the results of it, you know. So,
well, that's another thing as a director. Aren't you part of picking what we wear?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, we move so fast. You know, like Audrey, we have meetings in the beginning. And then and a lot of times she hasn't built it yet. So these are rough sketches and so forth.
Right.
I was very keen on certain things, like those shoes in that scene. I said to Audrey, I'm going to do a close-up of those shoes. So I need you to pick something. Yeah. The two people on that crew who were so talented and so amazing were Audrey and Bridget. Bridget Meyer was the makeup lady,
it's a tough job.
Oh my God! I don't think anybody worked harder.
My God.
She was there all 7 seasons,
all 7
80 seasons. Plus hour weeks every week
with kids.
Right? She would come in to my office at the beginning. I mean, when we had our meeting, she had every makeup change, pictures.
Yeah.
So prepared. And on top of it, she was running a department, which was the largest department on the show. They came in first. They left last. So Bridget, and she was extremely talented. So
You're absolutely right.
And I don't think we talk enough about these craft people who are so talented.
Yeah, we're interviewing them, and we're just so thrilled to show the incredible support that the show doesn't happen without. And that reminds me of a comment that you made to me. We ended up in the same hotel somewhere, Canada or something, and also in the commentary, you made a similar comment. They kind of tie together. In the commentary, it was talking about working with Alan and Greg and how that support was different for this show. And then when we had dinner, you said when younger directors ask you, like newer directors ask you, what's it like working for HBO? Like they're just dreaming of someday working for HBO. And you say, well, the first thing you have to do is climb over all the bags of money to get to the set. And because it was different, we were shooting a feature film every episode. You know, those shoots were 21 days to 25 days. And how is that different from what you experience otherwise?
Well, it's interesting because I was doing Breaking Bad literally the same time. Now, you go from HBO where, you know, can you please, you know, I it's impressive. I'd like to have a techno crane in my parking spot during prep so that people will respect me. And then you go over to Breaking Bad, where it's 8 days in and out.
Wow.
You have to do it just as a creative, just as intense stuff, but you have to find other ways to do it. You know, you don't have that luxury. So, you know, it's interesting. So on True Blood, every sixth scene, I was wiring somebody up and throwing them, you know, across the stage and stuff. And it takes time. You know, on Breaking Bad, you just can't do that. You have to find other ways to do it. And it's interesting when you work with creatives, you can do it. You can, if it's 8 days or if it's 21 days, the work will expand. The most important thing is having a vision, you know, like Alan has a vision and Vince Gilligan has a vision, and I connect with that. And that's what does it. You know, Greg Feinberg, you know, he knew how to spend money. you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And sometimes I felt a little guilty about it because, you know, I'm more accustomed to being, you know, more efficient or cost efficient. But we had an obligation on True Blood to do things that hadn't been done. I did things every episode that I had never done before.
So to that end, because you directed so many, because you directed the first non-pilot episode of the series and the finales and premieres and finales across the seasons.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, you know, a lot of what are what we consider sort of foundational to the look, the style, the feel of a show. You know, I'm curious from your perspective, because it certainly feels from ours that there's a large, your fingerprints are all over this show in the good way. And how you feel about that, is that a responsibility or a privilege? You know, how does that
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, as you know, I produce my own material as well. But when I do that, it started back on my first show, which was 30-something, where the idea was to break the mold. And television had been very, what do you call it? It's just formulaic. You know, good guys chase bad guys. They get the bad guy at the end.
And kill your father. Week. And then
we do it again next week. And and I, you know, and then they said, well, what's the look of the show? And I said, I don't want my directors coming in. And because initially, I do the pilot, so everybody's mimicking me. And I said, I don't want you to mimic me. I want you to bring something something unique. And every episode is a narrative unto itself. And you feed off of the writer. You don't feed off of what was shot last week or what's going to be shot next week. You feed off of that script. And I learned that from 30-something. I mean, literally the fourth episode we did was a musical. So we would switch it up. And not care, we get a lot of, you know, it scared people. But I felt on True Blood, there were no rules other than an appreciation for filmmaking. You couldn't be bad. You had to be good. And you had to you had to be cinematic, but not at the expense of the performance or the story. Those things must always come first. And when I read a script, and I was lucky, I worked with Rael a lot. I just happened to fall, her scripts happened to fall in front of me, Alan. And I really related to how they wrote. I could see it. And apparently when I did it, they said, that's how I saw it. And I go, well, that's good because I saw it in your script. And so that's what was, and it's interesting because that's, sometimes you think that's hard, but actually it's easier that way.
Yeah,
like when I read a Vince Gilligan script, I go, oh, this is easy. I see this. I can see this, you know. I wouldn't know what to do with, you know, a CSI, you know. That's actually very hard. I don't know what I could do, you know.
Yeah, I've noticed from episode to episode, no one does Sookie's telepathy the same way.
Yeah.
No one does vamp speed the same way. I mean, obviously, there's technical things that are repeated, but in terms of the artistic way that that's represented, it really does feel like each writer-director pair was given the freedom to represent that however they creatively saw it, which does feel unique.
Yeah, I think that's when you're working at HBO or one of these, you have an obligation not to be formulaic.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting. True Blood was on that precipice. It was before all the digital technology.
Yes.
And I keep thinking about all the vampires I blew up on the show, that the technique that we used to blow them up changed over the seasons. I mean, I started by, you know, having those 40-gallon, you know, barrels of blood that we used to let it go. And then we stopped doing that, and then we started filling balloons with blood, and then we started, you know, we kept changing our techniques as we learned, you know. So,
so
I remember I had to pull this this news director spying out of his body.
Yes.
And
that's the show.
But, you know, the thing is that this is the kind of thing that you can do today like this, you know, with digital effects, visual effects. But back then, it had to be physical. And the reason it was a spine wasn't because it was written as a spine. It was because Todd Masters happened to have one in the shop. And so we constructed, but that sequence is all physical. Yeah. There is not a single visual effect in it. You know, his hand comes through his body, comes back, he pulls the spine out, you know. It was all mechanical and physical.
Amazing. And how do you feel about that? Do you think that with CGI we lose something, or does the viewer not know the difference?
I think, you know, for me, I think visual effects works for you. But I think sometimes a director says, oh, I can do that. It's like, okay, the script says, oh, and 100 soldiers come over the hill. Mm-hmm. But now it could be 100,000 soldiers.
Right.
And then I go, wait a minute, now you're pushing credibility. Now I don't believe it, you know?
Right.
So just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. And so I think you have to put your own limiters on, you know? Yeah. And again, like I say, put script and performance first.
Performance is harder on a green screen when there's nothing there for us.
Very true.
I know, and you guys are now doing this like all the time now.
Yeah.
You were on Once Upon a Time, yeah. That's probably where I saw you in Canada.
Yes, that's probably where I saw you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I went from everything is practical to nothing is practical.
Right.
We were in a green room with one chair.
Oh, my God.
Crazy.
And,
you know, the dragon was a tennis ball and a stick. And I'm like, I am coming from another world. And I kind of looked at them, you know, when they would complain, oh, they were tired or what have you. I was like, what a bunch of wusses, right? Like, we're not outside all night actually covered in blood, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a shocking difference, and it really helped me to have it be as practical as possible.
As an audience member, now again, they can do anything and it looks really great. But I was watching something where like they rode by an erupting volcano on horseback.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I just know because I'm a person with a brain that they didn't really shoot that. That like nobody actually went out and found an erupting volcano and got on a horse and rode by, you know? And you probably shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But there is something awe-inspiring about that moment with Dennis O'Hare and pulling out that spine and knowing that creative minds spent time creating this thing for you and how exciting that is. That Smoke and Mirrors is exciting versus
it's
something that's digital, which is a lot of work, but it doesn't have that exciting impact in the same way, at least for me.
Yeah, it's scary too, because, you know, I did a show where I literally was dropping a piano on somebody. And so we did it all practical. We raised the piano up like three stories, and I had an IMO camera underneath.
Oh my God.
And other cameras shooting it. And it was interesting because we counted it. You know, I let the stunt coordinator count it down, and he go, you know, and I'm looking at all four monitors, and it goes, you know, 3, 2, 1, and then the IMO camera goes out. And the piano falls. And it jammed. So the camera jammed literally as the piano was falling. And you only can drop one piano. So and I never got that shot, you know?
Yeah. You never got that shot. Oh my
gosh. But it's scary too. You know, you're lighting people on fire on True Blood.
Oh, yeah.
You're, you know, we are, you know, out in the cold and cover. And there's all these, you know, features. You know, watching actually doing car stunts, things like that. It is scary, and your heart's a little bit in your throat. And the amazing thing about great stunt teams is that they, you know, I always say they're not risky daredevils. They are a safety department.
No,
stunts is a safety department, and they do these incredible things safely so that we can all experience that sensation of your heart being in your throat in a safe way.
Yeah, but you guys, it's like you go to war. I had to do a scene out at Greer Ranch. It's your typical thing, you know. It's Louisiana in the summer, and you're right. Making love on the grass totally naked, and then you run away and turn into a horse.
Right.
So,
exactly.
I remember coming to the location.
A Tuesday.
And so you're
a Tuesday walking on
you're walking up the driveway, and I hear this crunching. And I go, what is that? And I realize that the water had frozen on the ground. It was that cold. And Janina had to do, and Sam had to do a scene totally naked on the grass. So we brought in these like heating pads and stuff, but she couldn't speak. She was so cold, you know, she physically was having trouble getting words out.
Oh, my God.
But we kept going at, you know, inch by inch to get through the scene. And all of a sudden, then...
I mean, we're nuts.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, you know, and of course, it's supposed to be Louisiana in the summertime, so everybody's supposed to be hot and sweaty.
Yeah.
But it was crazy. And I've met a lot of people who thought we did shoot in Louisiana.
Oh, yeah. People are shocked when they hear it. And that is incredible how they would dress those trees and the location, put moss in the trees, and our eye believes that we're somewhere else. That was a very lucky show that we all got to sleep at home at night or in the morning when we got home.
So just to get a little bit granular here before we have to stop, before we have to stop, just because I'm curious, when a script lands in your hand, you know, what are the first few things you do? You know, how do you start finding your way into it so that when you show up for that first meeting or even that first day of shooting, you feel like you're ready?
Well, you know, a lot of times you don't get the script right away.
Right.
I remember, you know, I basically begged for a script because I'm getting on a plane tonight. And when I arrive in the morning, when I arrive tonight and then first thing in the morning, I'm going to have to sit in a concept meeting where the entire crew, you know, creative staff is looking at me to tell them what I need, having just read the script once.
Right.
So what I do is I stay loose. If I get the script, I get it. I'm on the plane and I write notes in the margins. What I do is I write, you know, if it's an image, if I say I want to have her silhouetted in the doorway. So I write that, or I think this should be a transition, or I think I would like to be able to get a high view. So maybe I'll use a crane on this day. And, you know, and really loose kind of margin notes. But those stick, you know, because when I read, I visualize and I just put the things that I see in my head in the margins. And I start there. And then it just, it gets more detailed as you go along. I should show you someday a breakdown, but I do every shot. I do the math. You know, when you're a director, you can't paint yourself into a corner. You know, you have to say, well, if I'm going to go on a dolly track and I'm going to build a track across here, I got to get more than one shot. I got to be able to make this become two or three shots, and then you have, you know, when you reverse, all the lighting changes and everything turns over. And if you forget anything that was supposed to be shot on the other side, you're fucked.
That's it.
No, and I do that. I actually say to my script supervisor or to my AD, I say, don't let me go, because I'm so guilty all the time. I always feel like I'm running behind. And so they help me not, you know, move ahead before I finish, you know.
Well, so here's a follow-up to that then, because again, as an actor working with you, if you came to set with every shot laid out and all these, you know, sort of storyboarded out, I also felt like if I came in though and said, oh, but I feel like I stand here or I would try to execute, you were so open to that. So it isn't like what you came with was rigid.
No, it's not. It's a security thing, knowing I have an approach, but it's only an approach. And then but I have the confidence knowing I won't get in trouble. And okay. And I'm going to tell you something. Sometimes you think you have free will, but,
I know.
Right.
But I do actually, and I said this to other directors, I said, look, I want to give the actors the sense of freedom and the fact that they, you know, can approach this. But there are tricks that you can use to manipulate them into certain things. You know, I say, when you enter a set, stand where the camera's going to be. Always, you go there because the actors will come around and go in front of you. Yeah. And you've already pushed them inadvertently into into similar positions.
Yeah, right.
And then like with you, Deborah, I know that if I give you an action that you can do something with, that you'll go for it. You'll embrace the action. And then there's the other thing, and each one of you is different. Kristen, do you want me to tell you what the shot is? Or do you rather not know?
I think I'd rather not know. I think I kind of want to I try to stay in a bit of a field of daisies and sort of pretend I'm not being filmed. And I kind of, I like what I'm hearing from you, and it's putting words to what I've experienced in love, is that it's good control. Being controlled well is a wonderful feeling. It's a safety net, right?
So being inspired.
It's being inspired. Like,
you can say control and manipulation. These are the modest words that you're placing on it, but it's being inspired. It's saying, here's, you know, a starting point, a foundation that has come to me. Can you build on this foundation, on this structure?
Yeah.
Makes me feel good and safe.
Rather than just saying, paint outside the borders, go, your frame.
I remember very distinctly, I did a scene with you, Deborah, where you were hunting. It was the first time. Mm-hmm. And I had this idea that I'd have a blank frame with very shallow focus. But I needed you to break that frame in an extreme close-up. And I wanted you to be like smelling blood. But I think you had to know that I was close.
Right.
Because you had to be very subtle. And I had to, a lot of what you were projecting was behind your eyes. It wasn't in front. And so, you know, so it was a dance, really. I wanted the camera to dance with Jessica when she walked into Merlot's that first time. And so it didn't distract you, I thought. I thought you actually enjoyed, and on top of which, and very few times he gets credit, but Simon Jase, our A camera operator and Steadicam operator, he was a creative, and the actors felt safe with him, and he was so sensitive. And, you know, I got to tell you, sometimes Simon saw stuff I didn't see.
Yeah.
And he would...
Well, we spoke with Simon.
Yeah, he would indicate to me that she wants another take. Even though the actor's not asking for it, Simon tells me. And because he has his eye so close. Yeah. And what a creative human being.
What a creative human being.
Yeah, he's a very it's a privilege to work with an operator who is so sensitive, especially when I'm tired, because you don't know how many times I set a shot, I walk away just to sit down. When I come back, it's all wrong. But with Simon, I don't have to ever worry because it's always right, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that was a very close relationship. I'll just say this one last thing, and then we're going to ask you an on-the-spot question. But After I answered that, like, maybe I do like to know where the camera is. That's a funny thing because I'm not even sure I know what I want. But but Simon, because that relationship was so comforting to me that he was a constant in our world.
Trusting, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And I was always working with knowing where the camera was, hitting my mark, waiting for it to land before I say the line that needs to happen next. Like, that dance in that set was just so important, so wonderful. Yeah. We're so lucky.
Yeah, and you knew that Simon's camera was the A camera.
Yeah.
So
a
lot of times you didn't even have to worry about the other cameras, you know.
Right.
You know, Simon kind of told you which direction you were walking, where the focus, where the emphasis was. And that's an unusual phenomenon and something that a director should never admit. But I honestly consider him a collaborator, like a, you know, a dance partner.
I did too.
Us too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've been asking everybody when they think back on their experience of True Blood. So this is from your perspective. If you could pick three words that come to mind about that experience.
Okay. I will say life-changing, fulfilling, and exhausting. So,
I love it.
That is so interesting. We've heard of, actually, that's a, what's so interesting.
Life-changing is not a word.
No, you get that. Allowed. And a lot of people have picked that. And that's what's something so interesting to me is how from all these different jobs and perspective and vectors, we have people saying life-changing, in the and something like fulfilling and exhausting.
Right. It was hard. It was not, it was physically hard. Like, you know, your body is not made to shoot 2 weeks of nights.
No.
You know, where you go to work at 5 in the afternoon and drive home at dawn.
Yeah.
For 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then the very next day come in the morning to shoot days.
Yeah, you that's brutal.
It is brutal. And I did a season finale. I had Eric and Bill, you know, burning at a stake while simultaneously there was an army of ghosts coming in.
Yes.
And then they pulled Lois Smith out, something out of her mouth. And it was like, you know, and then Nelson is thrown, you know, 50 feet across, all in one scene. And I think we shot it 6 nights in a row, you know.
Oh, my God. That's a finale for you.
We just watched that because that's in season 4 that we're interviewing you around. Uh-huh. And so that's so interesting. You comment on that. That was 6 nights. It was huge.
Right. And, you know, and the way and the reason I could do it was because of Sunday Stevens, the AD.
Yeah.
She, and that's the other thing about life-changing experience. This crew, these creatives, these actors, all of you guys were so stimulating and so exciting to work with, and it was hard, you know. Mm. I sometimes would be so nervous about reading my, you know, I'd see a call sheet and I go, "How the hell are we going to do this? You know, how are we going to do this?" You know, but you have Simon, you have Sunday, you have you guys. And that was the under, you know, not to mention the one or two, but other than that, a cast of nothing but hardworking professionals with a loving spirit across the board,
across the board. I've never seen that before or since.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Scott. This is such a pleasure. I mean, we could talk for hours.
I know. This was fun. I like going back.
I do too.
Us too. That's been the real joy of this podcast.
Yeah. And we just want to thank you. Thank you. I'll cry. You were there for little Deb's first night.
Yeah.
You made me, Scott. You're my real maker. I love Steven, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we adore you. We're so lucky we got to talk to you. We're so lucky we got to work with you.
Well, I'm clearly available, so.
Hopefully many more times coming up.
Yes, we're all available. Deb.
I have such a feeling of calm that comes over me. But also now, I'm so anxious. The experience of working with him is just so unique and none other that now I'm I want to do it now.
I know. I have so much tears in my eyes, because all the feels that he was so important to our experience.
We think about the family element and, obviously showrunners sort of have that parental quality. But Scott, I think, had that parental quality at least. And I speak as pretty young on the show, so I was looking at everyone in that way, maybe. But I do think that a really good director has that, benevolent parental quality sometimes because you need that. You need a leader who is on your side.
Yeah. I know I'd written in my notes in preparation for today, our fearless leader, all the feels, he's just the best.
Next week on Truest Blood, we discuss the overlap of psychology and magic with Kevin Alejandro.
He plays the insightful and noble Jesus Velasquez. We love what he brings to this role and how his character brought on a new side to Nelson Ellis's Lafayette.
So thanks for listening, Truby. Subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll see you next week.
Y'all come back now. You're here.
Truest Blood is produced by Safe Haven for HBO. Executive producers are Janina Gavankar, Kristen Bauer, and Deborah Ann Wool. Our producer is Gabrielle Galan, and our audio producer is Christopher Wool. Our theme song was recorded just for this podcast by Jace Everett. Additional music was composed by Timo Chen. And remember, you can watch all of the original episodes of True Blood on Max.